Yesterday, let's just summarize what we have discussed so far. Yesterday, we talked about the great principle of the harmony of science and religion. And we found that Abdu'l-Bahá has said that science and religion are like two wings of a bird. Both of them must be equally strong. Society will only evolve and develop when these two are equally strong. And we live in a period of time now in which there is an imbalance. Secondly, we looked at the two great principles of the physical world that we find in the Baha'i writings. Does anyone remember what these two great principles are? Remember? You don't remember? Principle number one is that the physical world is not reality. Physical world is not reality. And principle number two is that the physical world is a symbolic representation of the spiritual world. It's not reality, but it represents something. And then we looked at what Abdu'l-Bahá said about the value of studying the physical world in order to gain spiritual insight. Abdu'l-Bahá said, if we wish to understand what the spiritual life is, we must look to the material world, which is an outward figure or symbol of the inward reality. So if you want to understand, if you want to gain spiritual insight, you can gain spiritual insight by studying the various relationships and principles in the physical world, and these things give you spiritual insight. Then we discussed the ills that affect modern society, the evils in today's world, and we found that Shoghi Effendi had identified four of them to the American believers in the 1950s. Do you remember what those four are? Immorality, that's right. Immorality was one of them. I'm sorry? Racism, yes. Racism? I'm sorry? Political corruption, correct. Very good. Crass materialism, those were the four. Okay, and you might recall that I said to you yesterday that we can look at ways of addressing these problems by applying spiritual principles. Spiritual principles are the way in which you address a problem. And then I also said that why don't we try out what Abdu'l-Bahá said, look at the spiritual principles and see if we can find a physical analogy, a scientific analogy that will give us insight. If Abdu'l-Bahá says that you can understand something spiritual better by relating it to an analogy in the physical world, then let's try it to address these four problems. So, what I did was, I went in the Baha'i writings, and I tried to see what are the greatest spiritual principles to address these four issues. What spiritual principles could we look at, and could we study? And I found many, many spiritual principles. Then I thought about the four problems, the four ills of the world, and I looked at some other references where Shoghi Effendi talked about the ills of the world, and suddenly I realized that the ills of the world fall into two broad categories. They fall into two basic categories. One category is the ills that are primarily concerned with individuals, with you personally, things that you must do yourself. These are the ills of materialism, immorality, ungodliness, irreligion, and so on. Then there's another category of ills which relate to society. They're collective problems, and these relate to society. And these are the ills of political corruption, for example, nationalism, war, disorder in the world. All of these kind of problems have a more collective thing. So I said, what are the spiritual principles for collective problems, and what are the spiritual principles for individual problems? And I found many dozens of principles. But after studying them very carefully, I found what I believe to be the primary principle for each of these two. What I consider to be the main principle to correct the collective problems of mankind, and the main principle to correct the individual or the human problems. And I call these the two first principles. It's not in the writings. It doesn't say two first principles. Don't look it up. But this is what I'm going to call it. So what is the greatest principle to address the collective problems of mankind? What do you think it might be? Very good. Thank you. unity. In fact, unity is the pivotal principle around which all the Baha'i teachings revolve. That's what Chögyal Effendi said. The pivotal principle. Now, something that's pivotal means that everything else revolves around it. The principle of unity is far more complex than what we may initially imagine it to be. I said yesterday that as Baha'is, we need to sometimes go to the dictionary and erase the definition and then write in the new one. Well, there's nothing bigger than unity. You would need to erase the definition of unity in the dictionary and put a book in its place because of what Baha'u'llah has said about it. So we're going to first look at unity as the primary spiritual principle to address the collective problems of mankind. Then we're going to look at the primary principle for human, individual development second. And what do you think the primary principle is? What do you think would be, if you looked all over the Baha'i writings and tried to find it, what do you think would be the primary principle to correct human ills? Love, service, truthfulness, prayer, the number one principle. Humility, certitude. I found all of these, by the way, but one was higher. Obedience? No, that was number 92. No, I'm kidding. No. So I'll tell you what. We'll do unity first and look at it scientifically. And then when we come to this, you shall find out what I believe is the primary principle. Okay, I won't tell you now. Let you think about it while we deal with unity. So let's go to unity and let's look at some of the scientific principles that relate to unity. The first analogy that I find in the Baha'i writings that gives us a clue as to what unity relates to in the physical world is the comparison of unity to light. The comparison of unity to light. I did a search quickly in Ocean, that's the computer program, and I said, give me all the sentences in the Baha'i writings that have the word light and unity in the same sentence. How many do you think I got? 278. Okay, that has light and unity. Now, some of those may be reprints of the same quote, maybe Chögyal Effendi quoted Baha'u'llah, but still, a lot of them were unique. Baha'u'llah says, so powerful is the light of unity that it can envelop the earth. Sometimes we read statements like this and we just think, oh, it's just nice language. But maybe when we come across something where Baha'u'llah says the light of unity, we should stop and say, wait a moment. What are the principles of light? What are the characteristics of light? Why did he relate light to unity to light? If you'd asked me, like, Tom, what are you going to make unity like? I may not think of light first. I might think glue, or I don't know, so powerful as the glue of unity or something. light doesn't immediately spring to mind as being the physical symbol of unity. And yet in 278 places, Baha'u'llah refers to unity as light. So why does he do this? So, quickly, I wrote down what I think are some of the basic scientific principles of light. Just wrote them down quickly. Number one, light sheds clarity on things. Would you agree? Light sheds clarity on things. Number two, light is a spectrum of individual discrete colors. You know that light is not one thing. Light is actually a spectrum of colors, 7 colors, in fact, and that's why many musicians like to refer to light as an octave. It's red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. Okay. And sometimes when light hits something and then it bends because it reflects, the speed of light is different for each of those colors, and you can see the colors separated. You can see this in a rainbow. You can see it on soap bubbles. You can see it on a CD if you turn it upside down. You'll see the individual colors of light reflected, and you realize that light is actually a collection of individual colors. The third thing I wrote down about light is it is the fastest moving thing in creation. Okay, this is what Einstein postulated. Light is the fastest moving thing in creation. If unblocked, if light is not blocked, it will travel forever. This is one of the scientific principles of light. In other words, we have light that is unblocked. It comes to us from billions of years ago. It just doesn't stop. You can't stop light from moving if it's unblocked. These are just some of the principles I wrote down. Another principle I wrote down of light is created by movement at the atomic level. The creation of light, whether it be by the sun or any artificial means, but not artificial because there is no artificial way to create light, the way in which we create light or the way the sun creates light is by electrons, which are the little things that spin around the nucleus of the atom. They get excited and they move to a certain orbit and they come back down. And it's the movement coming back down from the excited state that causes the emanation of electromagnetic waves, some of which are light. Light is the result of movement and action. It's just a scientific principle. And of course, another great principle of light is that light is the means whereby our eyes perceive physical creation. It's a scientific axiom that we do not see physical creation. Let's make that very clear. Your eyes do not see the physical world. Your eyes only see light. Your eyes basically see only circumstantial evidence that physical creation exists. What does circumstantial evidence mean? Circumstantial evidence is like if you walk into a house and you see all over the floor horse manure, and you say, there must be a horse around here somewhere. Okay? Circumstantial evidence is evidence that is consistent with something being true, but doesn't prove it. That's what circumstantial, it means it's consistent, but it doesn't prove it. There could be another reason why that horse manure is on the floor, but it's probably, it's probably that a horse was there. So that's why you say it. Of course, if you have other circumstantial evidence, maybe you see horse footprints or horse hair on the ground, then maybe a lot of circumstantial evidence proves something. But still, a good lawyer is going to get that horse off, for good behavior, because circumstantial evidence doesn't prove. And here's what happens. Light goes into physical creation, and physical matter reflects light or does something to it. It either absorbs some of it and sends only some of the color spectrum back, absorbs all of it, or it reflects it, or it refracts it, it goes through, or it bends it, and so on. In other words, physical matter does something to light. And we see what physical matter did to that light. And then circumstantially, we deduce that physical creation exists. So light is the only means by which we know something exists. These are just some scientific principles. I just wrote them down because I'm saying, well, do any of these contain any clues to why Baha'u'llah decided that unity was a light? So I'm thinking about it and I'm thinking, okay, shedding clarity on things. If unity sheds clarity on things, then how does it do it? And it seemed to me, when I just thought about this a little bit, that if we have diversity and if we value diversity and we look at the points of view of people, perhaps we will get more clarity and more understanding. Maybe this is one of the great features of unity. Think of the old analogy where they say, imagine you have five blind men and they're all surrounding an elephant. And one blind man says, an elephant is like a snake because he's feeling the tail of the elephant. And another one says, the elephant is like this or that. He says it's like a big hose, because he's feeling the trunk of the elephant. So, and every person has a completely different understanding of what the elephant is because they're only feeling a certain part of it. Let's imagine instead that these are five men in a completely dark cave with an elephant, and they have eyes now. And each one has a little flashlight, just a pencil flashlight. And one can see the tail, and one can see the trunk, and one can see the foot, and so on, but none of them can see the whole elephant. I remember a Baha'i friend of mine, he told me, and this was just, a month or two ago, he said he was in a local assembly meeting, and he said something, and he told me what it was. Actually, he told me the thing first, and it was the most profound, beautiful concept, but it was quite hard to understand. But the way he said it, it was so beautiful, and I said, that's a really beautiful insight you have there. And he says, well, it's funny you say so, because I said it in a local assembly meeting not too long ago, and they all frowned at me and ridiculed me, and I felt very, very humiliated at the assembly meeting. And I said to him, try to comfort him, I said, well, you're a very deep thinker and very different, and maybe they just didn't really understand the wavelength that you were on when you said that, but it hurt him very much. And then it occurred to me that the chairman of that assembly, who had basically just poo-pooed him, was faced with a choice when that came to this chairman in the assembly meeting. The choice was to either have two eyes or four eyes. Anytime someone comes to you with a new idea or a different expression from a different background and they express something that you cannot grasp, you have the choice of just keeping your two eyes or getting their two eyes and suddenly you have four eyes. This choice faces you every day of your life and every moment of your consultation. If we let ourselves see through all of the eyes in a local assembly meeting, we would have 18 eyes. You see? And that is why unity is a light. So imagine we're in this cave and everyone has a little pencil flashlight. If we turn them all on, we can see the whole elephant. Because light sheds clarity, but only if you embrace diversity and you seek it out. We have to reprogram our brains, because at the moment our brains tell us any idea that's contrary to ours equals bad. It's like a little formula. Idea not coinciding with our idea, bad thing. We need to change that now. An idea that's presented that's different to ours equals great. Two more pairs of eyes. A completely new paradigm. And it's going to be difficult to reprogram ourselves. But this then makes unity like a light, because then it sheds clarity on things. I thought again about unity, and I found that quite often Abdu'l-Bahá, Baha'u'lláh, they related human beings to various metals. You know, iron, steel, gold, silver, you understand? And of course, metals are unique in physical creation, and that's why man is often symbolized by metals, because metal is unique. It can be forged, it can be changed into various shapes. You can make it this shape, that shape. You can transform it. It bends without breaking. Most things you do that and they break, you know, but metal you bend, and so on. So this scientific principle of metal is very interesting. So I tried to look at unity in relation to this. And I found there's a very interesting principle. It's called metallic bonding. It's part of the great basic category of atomic bonding, in which atoms bond together in various ways. And one way which they bond is covalent bonding, and so on. There's different ways. But metallic bonding is unique amongst all the bondings of all the atoms, because only in metallic bonding do they completely share each other's electrons. It's complicated. I don't want to go into it. But I want to tell you something that's very interesting, because this relates to unity. About 3200, 3300 BC, say about 5,000 years ago, a very interesting thing happened in the world. Somebody, I don't know who, but maybe a lot of people, they discovered that if you took an element copper, and if you blended it with the element tin, it created bronze. Now, you may say, well, what's so great about that? Well, let me tell you what they discovered. Copper is a very soft metal. And in fact, all pure metals are fairly soft. You can't do much with copper. You can't make a knife out of it because it can't go to a sharp point. You can't make an axe out of it because if you hit something, it just ends up being the shape of the thing you hit. You can't make tools out of it. It's basically just useful for, you know, pots and cups and so on, and not very useful. It's a very soft metal. You take a copper wire and pull it, you can just break it. You know that. Okay. Tin is even softer than copper. Now, after man discovered fire and heat, and then discovered that he could melt these things, somebody said, let's just mix copper and tin. I want you to think about this very carefully. You take copper, which is a very weak element, you mix it with a bit of tin, which is weaker, and it creates something that's more than three times stronger than copper. You add something weaker to it, and it's more than three times stronger. Unity in diversity in the metallurgic realm creates strength. And of course, we know now the scientific reason why this, you know, we can go into it, has to do with the fact that atoms that are slightly different, they hold together better because they don't slip and so on. I don't want to go into this. But isn't this fascinating that you can take two things, and they're diverse, but if you unite them, the result is three or four times stronger than either of the two. If this isn't scientific unity and diversity, I don't know what it is. But the story is even more fascinating, because we mark an entire age of human history by this discovery alone. Human history, early prehistory, is defined by the Stone Age, in which they had tools of stone, then the Bronze Age, later on the Iron Age. But the Bronze Age completely transformed every part of human civilization, from the way in which they live, the way in which they farm, the way in which they build cities and boats and tools. Every aspect of human society changed with just the discovery of this one principle of metallic bonding. Might it not be the same that when we discover the principle of human unity and diversity, that it will also create an entirely new age? Things that were not possible will become possible by the discovery of this principle. A new age based on unity in human diversity, just as a new age was created in the discovery of unity in physical diversity. The parallel is there, and we were already told by Aldebaran that the physical world mirrors the spiritual. So, metallic bonding, that's another scientific principle. The next principle I find is the principle of magnetism. Now, magnetism is kind of related because magnets are metallic, you know, copper can be a magnet, of course, and metal and iron. And I quickly typed in the word magnet in the Baha'i writings to see how much. I found there's 194 references to magnet. I didn't even look up magnetism, but in other words, many things are called magnets in the Baha'i writings. I also just looked up lodestone, because as you know, a lodestone is a magnet as well, and I found many more references to lodestones as well, and so on. So it's quite obvious that the manifestation of God, Shoghi Effendi, Aldebaran, were very interested in magnetism as a principle. And so I said, how does that relate to unity? Well, first of all, we're told by Shoghi Effendi that unity is a magnet. He says, the Baha'is should realize that the atmosphere of true love and unity which they manifest within the Baha'i community will directly affect the public and be the greatest magnet for attracting the people to the faith. In another quote, Shoghi Effendi says, the spirit and love among the friends in discussing, arranging, and carrying out the activities of the faith will become as a magnet, which will attract the divine bounties. And then I looked up all the other ones, the other 194, and I found that various things are told to us to be magnets in the Baha'i faith. Houses of worship are told to us to be magnets. Local assemblies are told to us to be magnets. Activity is told to us to be magnets. And service to the faith. In many places, he says, service to the faith is a magnet. And so I realize that there's various principles. Now, I've had the opportunity of hearing Peter Kahn, who's professor of electromagnetism in his profession, but is now a member of the House of Justice. And he always likes to point out, whenever we come across one of these writings on magnets, he likes to point out what is the difference between a magnet and something that's not magnet. Because he says, you know, we should become magnets. And he says, if you take a bar of iron that is not a magnet, and you take a bar of iron that is magnet, and study to find out the differences, he says you'll find that there are no differences in the elements. A magnet, a magnetic bar of iron, doesn't contain anything more in terms of atoms or elements than the magnetic. They don't contain anything different. The only difference is in the arrangement, the organization of the atoms. That's the only difference. So you have something, you have a group of people that have no power, you arrange a certain way, and suddenly a magic power appears. And this is fascinating, isn't it? That merely by organization and by order, a power can be created. A power can be created. And this is very interesting, because unity is a magnet if you do it. I want you to think very carefully from now on about service to the faith, and imagine that you are magnetizing yourself, or in relation to the Baha'i community, you're creating a great magnet. I want you to think about the five-year plan right now. Imagine it that if we are more obedient to it, we are magnetizing ourselves and our Baha'i communities. As we're driving to our study circles or our prayer meetings or intensive programs of growth or reflection meetings, say, I am magnetizing myself. It's a great spiritual principle that we deduce from magnetism. It's such a beautiful concept because Abdu'l Baha, I'll read you what he says. He talks about magnetism as the orientation of hearts and souls to God. He says this, note that thy Lord hath manifested the magnet, and he puts it in a capital M. So it's like this is the manifestation of God or something. Or he says, note thy Lord hath manifested the magnet of the souls and hearts in the pole of the existing world. And he capitalized pole. So it's like God is the pole and the magnet. He says, to which all the sacred hearts are attracted from far distant lands and countries. The iron body is attractable, although at long distances away. So we can be attracted. So the concept that we're all facing one way, because that's really what happens in a magnet. You know, it all flows in one direction. It's from that direction, it comes out, in that direction, it comes there. That's the two poles of a magnet. It's the flow. Electricity also flows this way. Where does a magnet point? North? That's not right. Where does a magnet point? It's just wherever the pole happens to be. The pole changes. Okay? About every 200,000 years, the pole is down over here, and then it moves up and back and forth, just like the manifestation of God. You know, the manifestation of God keeps appearing, and wherever he appears, that you can go to rocks in the earth, and if they're a certain age, they point south. You know, magnetic rocks, they pointed south. Because just like the manifestation of God, there's the analogy of the pole and the manifestation of God and the human being magnets, you know, orientum is complete in creation. Isn't that fascinating? So unity is a magnet, and if we can just arrange ourselves, we'll find this. Okay, I found a third principle, a third scientific principle related to unity, and in science we call this the principle of complementarity. Now it's a very simple thing to understand, but I want to explain to you what it is. In several passages of the Baha'i writings, we are told an example, which is the principle of complementarity. When Abdu'l Baha uses the analogy of two wings of a bird, and he uses this analogy in relation to two great issues. One, the equality of men and women, and two, the harmony of science and religion. He uses the same analogy for both. Men and women are like two wings of a bird, and science and religion like two wings of a bird. And this is the scientific principle of complementarity. That principle says that two things can only function if they exist with both. And the elimination of one means the other one has absolutely no capability. You have a bird with one wing, it can't do anything. And you can see this. Complementarity must be meditated upon. In fact, in the Buddhist or Eastern religions, they meditated on this principle. It's a very important principle in Chinese philosophy, yin and yang, and the basic koans, which, you know, the koans which they meditate. I'll talk about that in a moment. But you must meditate very carefully on complementarity. You must keep thinking about it. Think about equality of men and women, and think about the two wings of the bird, and meditate upon it. We see complementarity all about us in the world. You know, if I cut off one of my legs, then I lose the principle of complementarity. Can I walk just half as fast as I can with one leg as with two? No, hardly, but not even close. One time I broke my thumb. Have you ever broken a thumb? I broke my thumb, and for the first time I realized how useless these four fingers were without the thumb. I couldn't even button my shirt. I said, boy, I mean, just the thumb, the fact that it's the principle of complementarity. And of course, I remember anthropologists said that the development of the thumb in human evolution was one of the most significant parts of development, because having that. And I realized then, oh yes, complementarity, even in human evolution. It's a very important principle. There is an old, it comes from Chinese philosophy, it's a meditative concept. It says, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And you're told to meditate on this. Now, you don't meditate on it to figure out the answer. No, it's a facetious question. The answer is implied by the question. What is the sound of one hand clapping? It's nothing. It's nothing, because the principle of complementarity says that sometimes 50% is 0%. And we meditate on that. Now think about equality of men and women in the principle of complementarity. 50% is 0%. Think about the principle of complementarity in harmony of science and religion. 50% is 0%. And this is why the Chinese meditated on this principle. What is the sound of one clapping? Keep thinking about it. What can your one hand do without the other hand? Absolutely nothing. It's as far as clapping is concerned. You just try it. Okay, everyone right now. You didn't hear a thing. Okay, let's give a really big one-hand applause right now. Okay, nothing. Okay? That's what we're doing right now in relation to men and women. Obviously, then, we don't have equality between men and women right now. Would you agree? Because we would be doing. And so whatever Adibaha means by flying, that the bird will fly, we don't know what that is. We're not flying right now. But this is a great scientific principle, complementarity, that we can study in the physical world and then relate it to these spiritual principles, and suddenly we gain spiritual insight, as Adibaha had promised. When I think about unity, I think how challenging it is for Baha'is, because we don't really have a good idea of what unity means. As I said, you need to go to your dictionary and erase the meaning and redefine it. I know that Baha'u'llah has a completely different concept of unity than we have, because he said in Gleanings, and I quote, "No two men can be found who may be said to be outwardly and inwardly united." And I'd say, no, I'm sure you can find somebody, you know. So, in other words, his concept of unity is something far different. It's something quite different. And Shoghi Effendi talked a long time about what the Baha'i concept of unity is, the oneness of mankind in unity. And he said, let's not make any mistake what we mean by it. He basically said, unity is not some notion where we all get together and hold hands and sing kumbaya. He basically said that. He didn't put it exactly in those words. But he could have put it in those words. Let's see what words he used. He says here, "Let there be no mistake. The principle of the oneness of mankind is no mere outburst of ignorant emotionalism or an expression of vague and pious hope." See, he could have said, you know, hold hands and sing kumbaya. In fact, he probably was deciding. Should we go with kumbaya or ignorant emotionalism, expression of vague and pious hope? Oh, let's take the vague and pious hope. But he could have taken the other, right? And so often we think of unity as, oh, can't we all get along? Let's hold hands. Let's sing kumbaya. That's what we think unity means. And Shoghi says, let there be no mistake. Well, there is a mistake. And so then he goes on for paragraphs and paragraphs, and this is, as you know, in the World Order letters. And he just says all of the things which unity really means. He says, well, I'll read some of it, you know. He says, let there be no mistake. The oneness of mankind is no mere outburst of ignorant emotionalism or an expression of vague and pious hope. Don't you love that, vague and pious hope? He says, its appeal is not merely identified with the reawakening of a spirit of brotherhood and goodwill amongst men, nor does it aim solely at fostering harmonious cooperation among individuals and peoples. Its implications are deeper, its claims greater than any which the prophets of old were allowed to advance. Its message is applicable not only to the individual, but concerns itself primarily with the nature of those essential relationships that must bind all the states and nation members of one human family. It does not merely constitute the enunciation of an ideal, but stands inseparably associated with an institution adequate to embody its truth. And he goes on to explain that unity and the oneness of mankind is not just brotherhood. It needs order, it needs government, it needs the world order of Baha'u'llah, it needs all of these things, because unity is like the organization of a magnet. Organization is required. to create unity. If you have a chance, go to World Order Baha'u'llah. That quote I started is on page 42. And read it over and over again and meditate on what unity really means in the Baha'i faith. And go to your dictionary and erase that definition as soon as you've finished. I also find it interesting that Abdu'l-Bahá has described unity in terms that it's better to be united than to be right. This is so foreign to our understanding and our culture that we should just step back and say, whoa, Abdu'l-Bahá, it's better to be united than to be right. Unity goes higher than correctness or being right. I'll read you a statement about this because this is such a challenging principle. He says, "It is my hope that the friends and the maidservants of America become united on all subjects and not disagree at all. If they agree upon a subject, even though it be wrong, it is better than to disagree and be in the right. For this difference will produce the demolition of the divine foundation. Though one of the parties may be in the right and they disagree, that will be the cause of 1,000 wrongs. But if they agree and both parties are in the wrong, as it is in unity, the truth will be revealed and the wrong point made right." Now, I can't tell you how foreign that is to the concept of American democracy, individual rights and freedoms, and so on. We really need to think very carefully about this. Shoghi Effendi one time, I'm going to read this, Shoghi Effendi talked about the Baha'is in Iran and when they were having a little bit of squabbles. I know it's surprising to you to think that Iranians would ever have any disagreements or arguments amongst each other. But apparently that's the case, and The Guardian wrote about this, and I'm going to read you what he said. The Guardian writes, "During the days of Baha'u'llah, some of the prominent teachers of the cause in Persia were divided as to the station of Baha'u'llah, and at last wrote to him for arbitration." So they wrote to Baha'u'llah. And so Baha'u'llah had to tell them who was right and who was wrong. You know, one believed this, one that. And so they all said, "Oh, Baha'u'llah, tell us, you know, which side is right." Shoghi Effendi continues, "In answer, Baha'u'llah said that if they were united, both sides were right. And if they were divided, both were wrong." Isn't that interesting? That's a very big point, and this comes from an Iranian, you know? In fact, weren't you the one that wrote to Baha'u'llah for that? Yes. So this is a very challenging issue. This is a very, very challenging issue for us to accept the fact that unity has a higher priority than being right. And believe it or not, I know many Baha'is who have been so hung up on the principle that they are right and has caused disunity, that this attachment to being right has caused them sometimes to lose their connection to the Baha'i community, to the very faith itself. Devoted believers have lost their connection to the faith, sometimes even to the covenant, over an appreciation. Marriages have been destroyed, relationships with individuals have been destroyed because they have valued being right over unity. And we're told that unity has a priority over that. Clearly then, the principle of unity, the pivotal principle around which revolves all the social Baha'i teachings, is something we need to study and to try and understand and to try and grasp. And maybe some of the scientific principles that have analogies helps us to do so. And so I call your attention to that. Let's move on then, because I can say more on unity, but I think we want to get on to the second principle I want to talk about. And that is the principle that addresses human problems. And I asked you before, what do you think would be the primary principle? Selflessness, not bad. What is it?
Tolerance.
I'm sorry?
Tolerance.
Tolerance? These are all good. But every one of these revolves around a principle. In other words, when we talk about unity, a lot of Baha'i principles are around unity. I mean, the principles of administrative order, that's unity, right? Consultation. That falls under unity. Equality of men and women, that falls under unity. World government, that falls under unity. Universal education falls under unity. Auxiliary language, unity of religions, racism, elimination of prejudice. You understand? So there are many, many Baha'i teachings, but they come under the broad heading of unity. So what is the broad heading for all of these things you said? All right, tell you what. I'm going to tell you what I think it is. I'm going to tell you what I think it is. And I get this, and I was just looking in the writings to find words like primary or first or most important or something like this. And I finally found that in the Baha'i writings, the primacy for individual development can be summarized in the principle of the purification of the human heart. This is what I found is the primary principle. The purification of the human heart has primacy over all of these other things. It is an organizing canopy by which we can put so many of these other principles you said. I gained this, for example, the idea of the primacy of this principle from the very first hidden word. The very first. And not only is the first, he says, my first counsel is this. Possess a pure, kindly, and radiant heart. Purify your heart. I get this also from Baha'u'llah in the Kitab-i Iqan when he lists the steps which any seeker must take to attain his journey on the path of truth. And he says, one thing must be done first. I'll read that. When a true seeker determineth to take the step of search in the path leading unto the knowledge of the Ancient of Days, he must, before all else. What does before all else mean? It gives it primacy. Before all else, he must cleanse his heart. You see? So this is why I decided to put it up there. Then I found something even more interesting. All Baha'u'llah wants is our heart. He doesn't want anything else. He says in Gleanings, the one true God, exalted be his glory, hath bestowed the governments of the earth upon the kings. To none is given the right to act in any manner that would run counter to the considered views of them. That which he hath reserved for himself are the cities of men's hearts. Baha'u'llah only wants your heart. He just wants your heart. And so I decided that we'll use this and we'll study the human heart in relation to scientific principles. Now, before I do this, let's first of all define what is the human heart. Some of us may think that the human heart is the organ here on the left side of our chest that pumps blood. Okay. In fact, many languages and cultures do not use that particular organ to represent what we think of as the heart. Many cultures use the liver, many use the neck, some use the head, the stomach is quite common, and so on. In fact, I read a book, not a book, but an article on this subject where they studied what every language and culture has used in the body to represent this thing. And the most common was liver. Isn't that interesting? The liver was more common. And people that use liver, you know, they probably, I imagine that they would probably have songs like, you know, I love you with all my liver. Or don't go breaking my liver. Or home is where the liver is. And maybe I left my liver in San Francisco, you know, something like that. Yes, Persians, they use liver as the, exactly. And so the human heart that we're talking about is not this physical organ that pumps blood. In New Guinea, we used to use stomach. And all the translations they have, their heart, they say, you know, unite the stomachs of thy servants. Is anyone here from New Guinea? We do that. And of course, in America, you couldn't unite the stomachs because they're too big. So when we talk about the heart, we're talking about something that has no physical location. We're talking about the seat of our affections, the seat of our desires, our emotions. And Adabaha said that the heart comes under this big, broad concept, which is spiritual. It's part of mind. You know how he talks about mind and soul and spirit? And mind is the highest part of our soul or our spirit. And mind has, you know, the heart and the intellect. Intellect is also spiritual. This is what we're talking about, heart. When your physical organ, your liver, or your physical heart goes, this heart exists. And this is the thing we're talking about, cleansing. Baha'u'llah says, thy heart is my home. Sanctify it for my descent. So he wants you to sanctify the heart. So I said, okay, what are some of the analogies that Baha'u'llah uses, or Adabaha uses, for heart? And the first thing I found is that heart is most often made analogous to soil. I found that heart is most often made analogous to soil. In other words, the human heart has the same physical same spiritual properties as the physical properties of soil. There's an old song called Heart and Soul. Baha'is should change it to Heart and Soil, because that's the principle. I'm going to read you two hidden words, and I want you to tell me the difference between them. This is number 33 from the Persian. Hearken to the delightsome words of my honeyed tongue, and quaff the stream of mystic holiness from my sugar-shedding lips. Sow the seeds of my divine wisdom in the pure soil of thy heart, and water them with the water of certitude, that the hyacinths of my knowledge and wisdom may spring up fresh and green in the sacred city of thy heart. Tell me what's the difference between that hidden word and this one, number 78 in the Persian. Quaff from the tongue of the merciful the stream of divine mystery, and behold from the dayspring of divine utterance the unveiled splendor of the day star of wisdom. Sow the seeds of my divine wisdom in the pure soil of the heart, and water them with the waters of certitude, that the hyacinths of knowledge and wisdom may spring up fresh and green in the holy city of thy heart. What's the difference between the two? They're pretty much the same, aren't they? The last sentence is word for word, except sacred and holy are different. And sacred and holy mean pretty much the same. So Baha'u'llah pretty much repeats himself. He repeats himself. Now, manifestation of God is allowed to repeat himself. You'd agree with that, right? Except in the hidden words, this is quite startling, because we are promised in the beginning of the hidden words that Baha'u'llah will be brief. He says, we have taken the inner essence of what has been revealed unto the prophets of old and clothed it in the garment of brevity. So Baha'u'llah says, I am going to be brief. And yet in being brief, he repeats one thing virtually word for word. No two other hidden words are as similar as these two. And it happens to be the hidden word in which he compares the human heart to soil. He repeats himself. And you can easily remember that he repeats himself, because when we talk about repeating, we talk about a record or making a record or a broken record. And it just so happens that these two hidden words are number 33 and number 78. Okay? I have no idea why, but isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Now, so I said, okay. So, the human heart is like soil. The human heart is like soil, I said to myself. So I quickly... Oh, it's not a joke. Okay. It's just to help you remember it. I'll tell you another thing, if that one doesn't... Okay, for the people that can't remember the 33 and 78, let's think of it this way. Soil, another word for soil is the earth. You know, earth is soil. Remember that heart and earth are spelled with exactly the same letters. They're an N. Okay, in fact, you just take the H and take it from the beginning to the end. It becomes heart and earth, back and forth, heart and earth. So that'll help you there if you don't like the... If it's 73, if that's too hard for you... Okay. So anyway, so I quickly, like I did with unity, I decided to write down what are some of the principles of soil. What are some of the scientific principles of soil? And I don't know a lot about soil, but, you know, I just wrote down a few things. The first thing I realized is that many things will grow in soil. Not just one thing will grow in soil. You put a plant in soil, it will grow. So isn't this interesting? Because quite often we're told, only put this thing in your heart, don't put that thing in your heart. For example, he says, in the garden of thine heart, which is the same analogy, in the garden of the heart, plant naught but the rose of love. The implication clearly there is that other things you can put in that heart. Well, otherwise, why would he say it? How many of you actually have gardens? How difficult it is to keep other things away? It's hard, isn't it? You have to tend to it all of the time. You have to watch it. If you leave it for a week, you're in big trouble, because the things that you didn't want, the naught but the roses of love, okay, they're the trees of something else, and the rose of love is dead. So this is the first principle, that soil is very fertile for many different plants. Therefore, the human heart must be fertile for many things, good and bad. The heart is not good or bad. It just gives growth to many things. That's the first principle. Second principle I gain from this is that Baha'u'llah is explaining that the Word of God is like a seed. Like a seed. Isn't that interesting? In other words, it's just a seed. Think of a seed in relation to an oak tree or something like that, the difference between them. It's as if Baha'u'llah, sometimes when Baha'u'llah writes, he gives us all the teachings. Other times, he just gives us the seed. That's all it is. He gives you the seed. He knows that if you take it and you know where to plant it and water it, and what is water in this analogy? It's certitude. See, this is a very deep scientific analogy. Think about water and seed and plant and so on, and Baha'u'llah has explained to you what it means. But the concept that the Word of God is just a seed, it's as if Baha'u'llah doesn't sometimes give you the treasure. He just gives you the treasure map. And then you have to take that map, and then you find the treasure. And you find the treasure by planting a seed in your heart, watering it with certitude, and it grows. This is a very deep concept that we can meditate upon. We could study soil science and agriculture and all kinds of things and gain tremendous spiritual insight just by looking at this principle. The third principle I find about soil and growth is that you need to tend to soil quite regularly. Both the good and the bad needs to be tended to. In other words, you need to, the good stuff that you want to grow, you need to water and nourish, and you understand? And the bad things you need to pull out and weed. In other words, soil needs to be tended to. Would you agree? If you want it to work? And so this is another principle. We need to tend to the soil of our hearts. I hope that gradually we can carry around in our minds that our heart is soil. And keep this analogy, because it's very, very simple. Another principle is that the good things need water. They must be watered. You cannot just expect to throw a seed there and it will grow. You must nourish it. Another important principle, and this is very important, is you need to be able to identify what are the weeds and the bad plants. If you don't know what they are, if you go into your garden sometimes and say, what is that? Is that good or bad? Can I eat that? You know, sometimes I'll even taste it, you know, because I can't. You have to be able to identify what are the weeds and the thorns and the brambles and the thistles, you know, all the analogies we use. Because if we don't know what they are, we may just let them keep growing there. I remember one time I was in my backyard and there was this little thing that was about this tall. And I said, oh, that's probably a tree or something. I just let it stay there. You know, I could have pulled it right out. And I think a summer went by, you know. And I forgot to go back out to it. You know, I watched football games and did all the things they did summer. And I went out there, and the darn thing was a monstrous tree. It was about that thick. I said, how did that get so big? And I tried to pull it out, and I couldn't pull it out. Because I just let it stay there, you know, for a little too long. And I had to get a saw. And I was thinking as I was sawing it, I said, I could have just pulled this out 3-4 months ago. It's amazing. Growth in soil is amazing. But so we need to be able to identify what they are. Another principle of soil, I just wrote these down, you could probably find more, is that soil is not good or bad because it has weeds or good things. If it has a rose or it has weeds, the soil is not good or bad. It's just neutral. It will give growth to anything. And sometimes when we have bad things or evil things in our hearts, or we see other people have them, we think that they are bad or evil. But the soil is not bad or evil. It's just what's in there. You pull it out and it's gone away. It's a very important principle because it eliminates the concept of guilt and it gives you a mechanism by which you can choose. You don't say, I'm bad. You say, I got a weed in my heart. Okay. Another principle of soil that I found was that soil sometimes and usually periodically requires plowing. It needs to be plowed. And as you know, what plowing is that you completely turn the whole, all of it over. And over again, Abdu'l-Bahá referred to tests and difficulties as plowing of the heart. This was his analogy for tests and difficulties. I'll read one of them. He says here, the mind and the spirit of man advance when he is tried by suffering. The more the ground is plowed, the better the seed will grow. The better the harvest will be. Just as the plow furrows the earth deeply, purifying it of weeds and thistles. So, suffering and tribulation free man from the petty affairs of this worldly life until he arrives at a state of complete detachment. Plowing of the heart. Here's another statement. He says, the evolution of the spirit takes place through plowing up the soil of the heart, so that it is a constant reflection of the Holy Spirit. And Adabha talks about holy souls. That's what he says about holy souls. Holy souls are like soil which has been plowed and tilled with much earnest labor, the thorns and thistles cast aside and all weeds uprooted. So you see this, several quotations there. Adabha talks about how tests and difficulties are like plowing. As anyone's ever had their heart plowed, how many of you had your heart plowed? Raise your hand. Okay, everyone should raise their hand. And if you haven't had it, it's going to be plowed. It's going to be plowed. And when it is plowed, think of it in these terms, that sometimes you need to completely turn that soil over. So let's now turn our attention to this very important principle of what are the weeds? What are the plants and the trees that we don't want in our heart? Because if we only want to plant certain things in our heart, what are some of the weeds? So I went into the Baha'i writings and I typed various search things. Get this out of your heart. Don't have this in your heart. What is this? Okay. And I found some of the things which I can identify as the weeds of the heart. These are the things you need to pull out as quick as you can, because if you don't pull them out, they're going to be plowed out. And you don't want them plowed. You want to see if you can pull them. The first thing I find that is a weed of the heart is what Baha'u'llah describes as worldly desires and cravings. Worldly desires and cravings. And I got this from the statement in the Persian Hidden Words, approach me not with lifeless hearts, defiled with worldly desires and cravings. The next quote also supports this. He talks about vain and inordinate affections. It's pretty much the same thing, would you agree? Vain. And he says, in Gleanings, he says that we should eliminate the thorns and brambles. Thorns and brambles are like weeds, aren't they? Eliminate the thorns and brambles of vain and inordinate affections. Okay, that's a weed. Another weed is the attachment to material wealth. And we find this time and time again as something we need to pull from our heart. The attachment to material wealth, to money, and so forth. And as you know, in the Baha'i writings, attachment to material wealth comes in two flavors. The two flavors are, if you're wealthy or possess it, that you're proud of it or enjoy it. And the other flavor is that you don't have it and you want it. And they're both equally materialistic. He says, you know, he says, should prosperity befall thee? Rejoice not, and should abasement come on thee also, don't be sorrow. He says, if poverty overtake thee, be not sad. In other words, if you don't possess wealth and you crave it, that's equally materialistic to you possess it and so on. There's two sides of it. So we're all equally prone to this attachment to material wealth, whether we have it or we do not have it. The next weed of the heart is what Baha'u'llah defines as idle fancies and vain imaginations. And this is, how many times does this come up in the writings? I should have checked that one. You think it's a lot? You think it's in the hundreds? I think I'm going to do a count on that. Idle fancies and vain imaginations, in my understanding, are all the concepts in the world that we just blindly accept. Sometimes he calls it an imitation. We just accept it as being true. We absorb it by osmosis. You know, material things will bring you happiness. It's an idle fancy and a vain imagination. Gaining advantage over other people, that's a good thing. Your own race is better. Your own religion is better. This is true, that is true, and so on. How many things do we just blindly accept? These are idle fancies and vain imaginations. We need to just throw them away like throwing a suitcase off a train. Just every day you should throw one suitcase off the train. And every day, there's another suitcase, throw it off the train. The train's going to go and that suitcase is gone. These are idle fancies and vain imaginations. In fact, Baha'u'llah says we should empty ourselves of all learning. Empty ourselves of everything. That's a weed of the heart. Another weed of the heart, according to Baha'i teachings, is envy. Envy and or jealousy, which I relate those two to one thing. envy and jealousy. And I get this from the Persian Hidden Words, in which Baha'u'llah says, "Know verily the heart, wherein the least remnant of envy yet lingers, shall never attain my everlasting dominion, nor inhale the sweet savors of holiness breathing from my kingdom of sanctity." So envy is one of those weeds that you got to pull every last bit of it. Okay, there's an envy weed. Man, I better get every last bit of that, because he says the least remnant of envy, if a heart has even the least remnant of envy, shall never attain my everlasting dominion. Also, I find many other related themes to be compared to weeds of the heart. Any kind of ill feeling towards anybody or any person is a weed in the heart. You need to pull that from your heart. And I get this from this quote. It says, "We need to clear the field of existence from the thorns and brambles of hostilities and ill feelings." Once again, hostilities and ill feelings are compared to thorns and brambles. How many times are bad things called thorns or brambles or weeds in the writings? Another weed of the heart is discontentment. Isn't this interesting? Discontentment is a weed. And what discontentment means is that we do not like what God has ordained for us. We want something else. That's what's meant by discontentment. Baha'u'llah says, "The source of all good is trust in God, submission unto his command, and contentment with his holy will and pleasure." How many of us are discontent with our lot in life? And that's a weed we must pull. We must get rid of that. Shoghi Effendi says in this regard, "We often feel that our happiness lies in a certain direction. And yet if we have to pay too heavy a price for it in the end, we may discover that we have not really purchased either freedom or happiness, but some new situation of frustration and disillusion." So discontentment is a weed you must pull. The long obligatory prayer, how many statements are that they say, oh, you know, you say to God, "I wish only what thou wishest." That is pulling the weed of discontentment from your heart. Another weed that I find in the Baha'i writings, and you may not like this right now, and it's particularly timely to mention it, it's the weed of politics. We must pull politics from our heart. We have a principle in the Baha'i faith called the non-involvement in politics. But many Baha'is do not understand the principle. They think that the principle of the non-involvement in politics means that we don't join parties, we don't wear badges or have stickers, and we don't outwardly do it. But that is not what Shoghi Effendi said the meaning of non-involvement in politics was. He says, and I'm reading from Shoghi Effendi, "We should, every one of us, remain aloof in heart and in mind, in words and in deeds, from the political affairs and disputes of the nations." Non-involvement of politics means your heart shouldn't be involved and your mind shouldn't be involved. Shoghi Effendi continues, "We should keep ourselves away from such thoughts." Keep ourselves away from such thoughts. Did he say keep ourselves away from such actions? Non-involvement in politics means non-heart involvement in politics, non-thought involvement in politics. You know, we're living in a time now, every 4 years we have this ritual here in America, you know, where we have elections. And the whole world gets caught up in it. And it happens in every other country that I've lived in. They get caught up in it. It's just always the same. It's always the same, over and over again. One party says do this, and you think that, and one party says do this, and you think to do that. And all they're really doing is asking you to change deck chairs on the Titanic. That's all they're doing. There isn't any difference. I like to think of it this way. All politicians could say the same thing. They could stand up and say, "The other party has been robbing you for years. Now give us a chance." And that's really all it is. And, you know, if you think that either party is a little closer to the Baha'i faith and therefore we should put our heart in it, just think again. There isn't either party in any election that's remotely closer in reality. It would be like where Baha'u'llah is going is the galaxy out there. And we've got two rocket ships, and one's on a 30-foot platform and one's on a 50-foot platform. Maybe one is a little closer, but it's insignificant. Just tell yourself, anytime your heart gets dragged into politics and your thoughts get dragged into politics, Just tell yourself over and again that Baha'u'llah said, this order is lamentably defective. Every time you see it on TV, just say, lamentably defective. And then say to yourself, Baha'u'llah said, soon will the present day order be rolled up. Why mess around with something that's going to be rolled up? How many of you ever stay in hotels and before you leave the hotel room, you make your bed? No, you don't. If you do, why bother? You know that the maid is just going to come in and clean it and make the bed. So you don't mess with a bed that's going to be rolled up. Just leave it there. Baha'u'llah says, soon will the present day order be rolled up. Just leave it alone. It's going to be rolled up. And I tell you the reason that we need to do this and keep it in our thoughts is that if we dwell on politics, if we follow it, we think about it, we talk about it, then many of the characteristics, confrontation, adversarial relationships, character destruction, you know, all the things, we absorb them into our heart. They become like weeds and grow there. And then they manifest in our Baha'i communities and our activities. You can't tell me that Baha'is do not have a reflection of some of these things of politics in our own Baha'i lives. You can't say we're totally free. It's impossible. But the best thing we can do is follow Shoghi Effendi's advice and to be free in heart and mind from politics. Now, in all cases, weeds of the heart, we have two choices. We can either pull them out or we can wait to get them plowed. We can wait to get them plowed. And it's your choice. I don't have much time. What is it? I only have a couple minutes. So I'm not going to be able to finish what I did today, what I prepared. But, you know, I'll mention a few things. What I find in the Baha'i writings is that what goes on in your heart, the soil of your heart, is more real than what happens in the real world. This stems from the two principles that physical reality doesn't exist. Okay, if physical reality doesn't exist and the real world is the spiritual world, then what goes on in the spiritual world within your heart is just as real or even more real. And it is only a materialistic view that thinks that what happens in the physical world matters and what happens in the internal world doesn't matter. That's a materialistic concept. And consequently, anything that takes place in the heart is actually taking place. And we should think about it very carefully, because the materialistic view says if something does no harm in thoughts and in intellect, then it's fine. If it does no harm in the physical world, it's fine. You know, as long as it's not acted out in the physical world, whatever goes on in the intellect or the mind is fine. What's not doing a harm? What's wrong with it? So they see no problem in, you know, pornography, violence in the arts, the media, and so on. And then they get so upset when they find that people act out in the real world what goes on there. That is because of this thing. You planted a seed in there, it grew, it got to a certain size, and it acted out. Whatever is in the heart will ultimately be acted out in the physical world. But the true reality is in the heart. We know this even from Christianity. Christ said, and this is in Matthew 5:28, he says, you have heard that it was said by the time of old, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman in lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. In other words, it's the thought that counts. In other words, you already committed adultery in your heart. And this is a Christian concept. This is a very old idea, that reality is what goes on in the heart and mind, not what goes on in the physical world. And so this is a very important principle. If you want to eliminate any bad trait, do not try and curb the physical expression of that trait. Try to eliminate it from your heart, and then the physical expression will disappear. If you want to stop backbiting, don't keep trying to stop backbiting. You'll just keep doing it. But if you try in your heart to have no ill feelings towards people, no bad feelings towards people in your heart, then backbiting will not be an issue in the physical realm. And this is true of every negative trait. The heart has primacy. Baha'u'llah only wants your heart. That's all he wants. So I'm going to conclude now because I missed three or four points that I would have said, but it's okay. There's plenty of time to go over this in the future. My understanding is that by looking at spiritual principles, we can learn more about them by looking at the analogies that Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá use, and then studying the scientific principles there, and then relating them, and we gain insight. Today we've gained insight just a little bit into only two spiritual principles, the principle of unity and the purification of the human heart. I wrote down and did study, and I found some 30 or 40 different principles and analogies that we could look at. And if we had a whole course, and this is something that any of us can do. It's very, very easy to do. And it occurred to me that science and religion then have a very, very wonderful relationship, because science can help us to understand these spiritual things. And the advancement of science makes the manifestation of God more capable of expressing deeper spiritual truths. In the past, manifestations of God taught mainly by parable and allegory. They taught by parable and allegory primarily, and a little bit of direct symbol. What I mean by direct symbol is you just say unity is like a light, or they, you know, this is like soil, and so on. But in order to use direct analogy, it requires the recipient to understand science and the principles of that. So in earlier times, the manifestation of God, he only had a limited amount of direct symbol that he could use, because we didn't know so much. So the manifestation of God taught more with parable and allegory, which are stories extended that explain things. If you look in Baha'u'llah's writings, you see there is parable and allegory, but a lot more direct symbol. Isn't that interesting? It's like the evolution of religion. Because science gives the manifestation of God a greater and richer language by which to communicate spiritual principles. And so we can spend a lifetime of spiritual understanding and insight by relating scientific principles to religion. And fortunately, the manifestation of God has already mapped these things. He said, unity is like a light, the heart is like soil, and so forth. And I hope in the future we can explore many more of these concepts and gain much more insight, because in reality, the harmony of science and religion is not just that science needs to become more religious, but it's also that our religion needs to become more scientific. Thank you very much.